Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's programme, Interstellar Travel Part 2. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can tweet us, we're at News Talk Science, or you can WhatsApp us, 087-1400-106. First up, we are looking back at the week's science news, and joining me, I forgot what we were doing, Lara, is Dr. Lara Dungan, immunologist and MD, and Dr. Oran Kennedy from the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. You're both very welcome. Lara, our first story has to do with women in space.
That's it exactly, Johnny, and that's certainly what the headlines are focusing on. Now, what I do want to tell you is there is a lot of really interesting science in this paper, but the headlines are certainly focusing on the sex difference between female and male astronauts. This is a paper that was just published in Nature Communications by a professor called Christopher Mason, who works in Cornell Medicine in New York. And he looked at the four astronauts who came back from the SpaceX Inspiration 4 mission back in 2021. And what he has done is really, really cutting edge modern science. And it's the way an awful lot of science is going these days. People are looking at the genetics of single cells. And that seems crazy because what we always used to do was gather as many cells as you possibly could. So say you're doing kind of a, you know, an old fashioned DNA test, to put it in sort of more basic terms. You'd gather as many cells as you possibly could. You'd bust all those cells open. You'd smush all the DNA together and you'd get a picture of what they all look like. Our techniques have advanced so incredibly that we can look at the genes in a specific cell. So one cell, what genes are being transcribed and what proteins are being made. And it is fascinating to look at, very hard to understand all the data and understand why it might be relevant. But that's what these researchers did with these four astronauts who came back. And what they looked at was their different types of immune cells and what proteins they were and weren't producing. Now, what I think is fascinating is the results they actually found. So one of the things they found was that some of their cells down-regulated or reduced the amount that they showed a particular protein, which helps to tell your body you have a viral infection. And I think that's really interesting because what it's suggesting is that people who go up to space for any prolonged length of time might actually be much more susceptible to getting viruses. So it might be weakening their immune system. And the other thing they found was that these regulatory cells, so these are cells that are very important in everyone to help suppress immune responses, these were increased in these astronauts. So again, it's sort of working towards a more suppressed immune system. Now, they're essential for everyone, but if they're overactivated, it can suppress your immune response. But what they did find was that in these four people, the two women had, I suppose to put this in more basic terms, they had suffered less from this. So the men were more susceptible to the effects of space and their immune systems were more deranged afterwards. And they compared these to 64 other astronauts that they had DNA from in the past. And they found a lot of this sort of bore out. And it's really interesting. I think what's fascinating is the massive changes in the immune system from space travel. Mm. But also that women, I suppose, are more robust and maybe more suited for space travel in this specific and particular way.
Do we know why those changes happened to the immune system?
We don't, and they don't either. And actually, it's quite fascinating. I suppose there are presumably multiple different reasons. And I would imagine that the radiation that people suffer in space is not going to be insignificant in this. But they don't have the information. Now, estrogen is incredibly protective, and we have known this for a long time. And whether or not that's part of it, that sex differences and the difference between men and women in terms of their immune system, their genetics, is so, I suppose to say it better, it's so sexy at the moment. Everybody wants to know why sex differences are there, what they mean, and how can you utilize them to help treat diseases in other people. I mean, you know, pretty much everybody who gets multiple sclerosis is female. There's a huge amount of terms of sex differences and diseases. So women and men are not the same creatures by any means, but they don't have the answer to why it matters in space, but I'm sure that will come down the line.
Yeah, there was even a very interesting evening in Trinity College Dublin where they brought back some of the most luminary names in science to talk about the sex differences, particularly when it comes to the immune system in Trinity this week. Our second story, Oran, has to do with cancer cells.
Yes. So the headline from this study is, this article, is that glowing dye for cancer It's about a study that was published this week in the European Journal of Nuclear Medicine and Molecular Imaging by a group of medics and scientists in Oxford University in collaboration with a California biotech company called Imaginab, and it was funded by the Cancer Research UK organization. It relates to prostate cancer, and that's the second most common male cancer globally, with about 1.5 million new cases each year. Those cases are normally treated by robot-assisted laparoscopic radical prostatectomy. So that just means using a robot to help using keyhole surgery to remove the whole prostate gland. And this study used 23 men undergoing this surgery. And what you really want as the best outcome, it's called the trifecta for optimal outcomes from this surgery, is undetectable post-op signs of the of prostate cancer, urinary continence, and erectile function. So those are the things that you want to see. It was quite hard to get all those three things together. And the limitations are caused by, during surgery, the difficulty in identifying the prostate and where the cancer is, because you want to remove enough, but not too much. And that involves, you know, the little blood vessels around it and all of that kind of thing. So you want to preserve as much as you can, but you need to remove everything because it's dangerous, but it's very hard to make that distinction. So these three men, they got a dye. They just got a little dye injected before their surgery. And the dye had two parts. One part was a chemical to attach very specifically only to prostate cancer cells, not just prostate cells, but prostate cancer cells. So it would be attached to the cells that you want to remove. And the other part of the dye is a little molecule that's fluorescent. So if you shine the right type of light onto it, it will reflect back quite strongly and sort of show itself during the surgery on a screen, and you can actually tell and make the decision much more kind of quantitatively, I suppose, of what to remove. And this is really important for lots of reasons, especially in prostate cancer, like I said, because you need to get everything out, but you don't want to take out too much and then affect continence and sexual function and so on. So one of the authors said, you know, it's really the first time we've managed to see such fine detail in prostate cancer during real time during surgery. So it's a big advancement, I think, in this area. And the outcomes were really, really good. And even though this study, it's the first in man trial with prostate, all of the people involved think that it could be adapted to other forms of disease and hope that they can use, you know, the same kind of dye, but with a different other parts of the injection to attach to other kinds of cancer cells and apply the same thing more broadly. So it's really exciting, really interesting, and really useful study, I think.
And I suppose the thing about this is that it's in real time. They can monitor it while they're doing surgery, and this dye sticks just to cancer cells. It really lights up the tumors specifically.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really, I mean, I don't know if anybody's interested in this, you should go and look up the paper, just even to see the pictures, because it's a very visual thing. And, you know, on the one hand, what people would normally see is kind of a mess of brown and green or brown and red stuff. And then, you know, the image that shows this reflection, it's night and day. You know, it's a big bright light showing at a cellular level each individual cell that has this, you know, and it gives the surgeons, I guess, a much greater chance of clearing out enough without going too much.
Brilliant. Our third story, Lara, has to do with IBD, which I think, you know, unless you know someone with IBD or unless you've been affected by IBD, I think most people completely underestimate the impact of this horrible condition.
Do you know, that's absolutely true, Jonathan. And I suppose some people probably mix it up with a similarly named condition, but significantly different, called IBS, which is irritable bowel syndrome. But IBD is inflammatory bowel disease, and it's made up of two diseases, ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And both are or have the potential to be extremely severe, especially Crohn's disease, which can affect you actually anywhere from mouth to anus, anywhere from across the alimentary tract, all the way from your mouth, all the way down to the far end. And some people have to have, for instance, an ulcerative colitis, it only affects their large bowel, and some people have to have their entire large bowel removed. Some people with Crohn's disease have to have any part of their small or large bowel removed, and people die from this. People have significant pain. It's a really serious disease. And this new paper that was just published in Nature by Dr. James Lee, who works in the Francis Crick Institute in the UK, is actually really interesting because it does give hope to patients with inflammatory bowel disease that there may be treatments out. But mechanistically, the way they did this research, I think, is really interesting. So as you will know, or anyone who listens to the show, we do, in medicine, people do a lot of genetics. And a thing that is done is called a genome-wide association study. And that means you take, say, 300, 400 people with a disease, and you you look at their entire genome and you look to see if anything flags up in a lot of these people that it doesn't flag up in healthy individuals. And that's done with lots of diseases, and it's been done with inflammatory bowel disease. And I'm sure there's hundreds of genes that have jumped out. But some of these genes are not in areas of the DNA that are supposed considered to be quote unquote important. And that means that they're not in areas that are transcribed into RNA and become proteins. They're what some people would call, I suppose, junk DNA or gene deserts. These are areas where there aren't considered to be important genes. And that is where they looked in these patients with IBD. And they found a thing called an enhancer. So an enhancer is something that allows for the gene near enough to it to be transcribed or to be made into a protein at a very high level. And they found this enhancer inside these patients with IBD, and it upregulated a gene called ETS2. Now, I know this is quite technical, but the point is ETS2 is in an immune cell, and it causes the immune cell to be overactive. And inflammatory bowel disease is an autoimmune disease. So this part of junk DNA or desert DNA is actually really important for causing the overactivation of a vital immune cell. And they think that this is going to be very heavily linked to one of the causes of IBD. And the interesting thing is there are already treatments out there that can target this, that have the potential to target this route. So it's not really starting from scratch with this. And it seems to be a very interesting and quite an important gene. And to find this enhancer and to find that it is genetically different in 95% of people with IBD is really fascinating and gives a lot of hope. I mean, we're not talking about a treatment being ready this year, but hopefully within, you know, 5 to 10 years, this might be something that can be used to treat patients with this debilitating condition.
To have a therapeutic target is fantastic because, as I say, it is an awful, awful condition. Our final story, Oren, has to do with elephants.
Yeah, so slightly more upbeat talking elephants. Slightly more upbeat than the last few stories. But this is a study published recently in Nature Ecology and Evolution by a group of scientists in Colorado, in the US, and Norway, and Kenya. So voice labeling, or just giving a thing or a person a specific name, is actually quite an advanced thing that until now we thought that only humans really clearly did. Other sort of smart animals, dolphins and parrots, can and do indicate to others, other animals, that they want their attention, but normally they do that, and this is sort of, you know, it's common enough in the animal world. They imitate the sound of the addressee. So that means, as in, if I wanted your attention, I would do or say something to try and sound like you. That's how a lot of animals indicate that they want attention. So anyway, this group recorded a lot of elephant sounds in Kenya, and they used an AI machine learning system. So just a big kind of algorithm to analyze the sounds, and in the field they observed the elephants' responses to these sounds to try and figure out if they had names. So they recorded about 470 calls with, you know, from known elephants, and compared and observed the responses from other receiver elephants to determine whether there was call information that identified the receivers. It's a kind of a scientific way of saying if there was a specific name given by one elephant to kind of communicate with another. So they compared, it's kind of harder than it might sound. They had to ensure a clean experiment. So they compared the similarity of calls from the same caller and the same receiver, and from same caller to different receivers. And they wanted to rule out that idea that they might just be imitating the other elephant that they're communicating with and all of that. And then they played them back. So they removed the caller elephant and they just played back the sounds to sort of confirm their findings. And what they actually looked at in the receiver elephants was, as in how they knew that the receiver elephant knew they were being called, was that that elephant would approach more quickly, approach the sound more quickly. They vocalized and they produced more vocalizations in response to the playback of what the scientists thought was their name.
So it's very interesting. And I suppose, to me, unsurprising. I don't know. I've always thought elephants were smart. I mean, it's probably to do with elephants never forget and other sort of like fairy tales in which elephants, you don't really hear about stupid elephants very often. But I don't know. Yeah, I got the sense that there's a bit of a tangent here, but I get the sense that they're pretty sentient animals.
Yeah, and I didn't realize this either, but apparently it was having a specific name. It's quite a higher order kind of evolutionary development. And actually, this journal is sort of concerned with evolution and all of that too, as well as sort of animal kind of cognition. But apparently, specific names, it's quite an advanced sort of stage to have reached. And everybody presumed elephants, they're smart and all that, but they use the more traditional thing of just imitating the person or the elephant that they're trying to communicate with. And so the other interesting thing about this is that they use AI and machine learning to analyze. And it's this thing, I know you've talked about a lot in the show, that, you know, with AI analysis, it's a sort of a statistical correlation thing. They don't actually know what the name is. So the algorithm will tell them that I think this elephant is calling that elephant, and it recognizes its name, but they can't figure out which grunt or groan or which like part of the data set is the name. They don't know what it is. They just know that associatively it's there, you know, and that's a common feature I found in a lot of these emerging studies with AI. It's just, it's able to calculate so
the
much
end,
so
the
fast
end result, but they don't know what's going on in the
they don't know what's going on. So they'll be able to say, if you teach a system and say, you know, this is this and that's that, and now you go and do this whole much bigger data set, it'll be able to do it, but it might not be able to figure out why it's able to make those decisions. So that was the case here. They don't know what the actual, they can't tell what the elephant's name is. They just know that within that sound there's a specific name for this elephant.
Okay.
That elephant. So really interesting stuff again.
Really interesting. Well, Dr. Oren Kennedy from RCSI and double Dr. Laura Dungan, thanks very much for joining us. Now, a few weeks ago on the show, we learned of a group called the Interstellar Research Group, a bunch of scientists, engineers, and science fiction fans, who were carefully and methodically undertaking all sorts of research to see if we could one day make interstellar travel happen, whenever that might be. And it's such a fascinating area that we wanted to return to it in this week's episode, because the subject and its challenges are so vast and at the same time really, really interesting. So joining us now is Les Johnson. He's co-editor of a book for the Interstellar Research Group that brings many of these ideas together. He is also, by the way, chief technologist at the NASA George C. Marshall Space Flight Center. Welcome to the program, Les. The challenge has so many fronts that it's almost impossible to crunch into an individual interview, which is why we're speaking about this again only a few weeks later. But one of the things that I thought was really interesting flicking through this book is the challenge of time, that time is an issue, and you've devoted quite a large section to it. Can you explain why time is a question when it comes to interstellar travel?
Well, one thing we've learned about distances to the stars is they're really, really vast. And when you start talking about covering these incredible distances, that we talk about something moving as rapidly as light taking years to cover, we have to start thinking about nature's speed limit, which is the speed of light. And according to Einstein and everything we've observed in nature, that is the upper speed limit. So if you're talking about going to another star at these distances, even if you travel as fast as nature is going to allow, it will take years, decades, or centuries to get there. And I don't believe anytime soon, maybe never, will we have spacecraft that can go really, really close to the speed of light, because the challenges of doing that are just tremendous. So even if we get at like 10% the speed of light, to get to the nearest star suddenly is 40 to 50 years, if not hundreds or thousands of years. And so when we think about mounting a voyage like this, it makes me think of what the cathedrals of Europe or the Great Wall of China, where people who began building these things have a vision of the future that won't be completed in their lifetime. It's something that they have to believe in, that's worth doing, that's important, that might take generations to accomplish. And that's the notion of time. I think we really don't appreciate in our own history, because we're limited to our, you know, 40 and 10 years that we live, that some things are just going to take longer than the human experience.
In this particularly, you talk about clock images and travelers' clocks in relativistic travel. What does that mean?
Well, wow. That's the topic for a whole lecture by a bunch of physicists with a chalkboard and lots of chalk and lots of time. What we have observed in nature, and it has been measured, is that the rate at which time passes depends upon your frame of reference. And what I mean by that is, if you're in a frame of reference on a spacecraft or something that has accelerated and is moving faster, the rate at which your clock ticks is different than my clock here on the ground. We have measured this on the space station. We have taken very precise atomic clocks on the space station and found that they run slightly slower on the space station than they do on the ground. We have done experiments in the laboratory looking at the half-lives of certain radioisotopes, because nature says that certain radioactive particles will decay in a certain amount of time. Well, ones that are moving really fast, their decay time is different because they're moving really fast. And so it turns out that this notion of space being absolute and time being some invariant absolute is totally false. That is a perspective that we humans have because we're all in the same reference frame. Once you get out and you start moving at some significant fraction of the speed of light, let's say we get up to 90% or better, you could potentially notice on a voyage to the stars that from your perspective on the spacecraft, the trip might take a certain number of years, but on Earth, twice that many years will have passed. So you have to be able to correlate how fast you're going, calculate how fast your clock is ticking relative to those you left behind, and be able to compare that, or you will not understand what's happening back home. So you might get to Proxima Centauri B, one of the nearest stars with a planet around it, and it might take you subjective time on the spacecraft, 40 to 50 years to get there, and 100 years has passed back on Earth. Just depending on how fast you're going.
Wow.
So it makes a big difference, and you have to account for that in everything. And lest your listeners think that this is some esoteric problem that doesn't impact real life, it impacts everything. GPS, which we use for precise positioning here on the Earth, has to take into account relativistic effects, not only from the velocity of the spacecraft, but the fact that the Earth has mass and that affects the rate at which time passes. So all of those corrections are factored in to something as simple as you being able to get across town using the mapping software on your phone. In order for that to be precise, some of Einstein's relativistic corrections have to be applied.
I'd never really thought of it in that practical terms. Of course, I'd heard of relativity and so on. But when it comes to applying that these sort of ideas to something as enormous as such an immensely long journey, of course, some of these, these effects are going to be pretty large. What sort of effect will that have on communicating with a generational ship?
Well, I also read a lot of science fiction and write science fiction where people have played around with this, right? You go on the voyage and you, let's say you're a parent and you just had a child born. When you arrive, a few decades have passed, but they may die of old age before you get there, right? So I think there'll be not only the technical implications of keeping up with what's happening at home, right? But I think there'll be the personal dynamic for any explorers that go, not only leaving things physically behind, but leaving behind any hope of connecting at all with your former life. And I think that psychologically would be really challenging.
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, you could imagine if you're traveling 1/10 the speed of light and you're communicating using light, that it is theoretically possible for the light to reach that craft and come back. But long periods of time will have passed.
Yeah, 10% the speed of light would not have significant relativistic differences. There would be some differences, but it would not be measured in decades or years, right?
Right.
That really only comes into play if you're traveling, better than 90% the speed of light. Now, it might be days, months, years, depending on how long you travel or how far you're going at that speed. So you'd have to take it into account, but it may not be as significant as what I just mentioned. If however, we find a way to go 90% the speed of light to get to Alpha Centauri in 4 years, you might find a lot of time has passed back on Earth. So it's challenging. I haven't done the math for that particular voyage. One of the people in the book did. So I would encourage listeners to go check out the book.
The concept of a generational ship we've talked about on the program before, but I suppose when it gets down to the nitty gritty, you need to have a think about exactly how many people you send on a trip, because presumably it'd be very, very difficult and very time intensive, cost intensive to undertake any sort of a voyage like this. There's some work undergoing that you report in the book about figuring out optimal crew size. Tell me a little bit about that. How many and what sort of a crew are we thinking currently, according to this research?
Well, there's a lot of disagreement on that, as you might expect. And the author who contributed this has tried to distill that into the chapter. It's Andreas Hein. Think of it this way. If you have to take a voyage that's going to take 1,000 years, say, to some habitable planet somewhere, you're not going to be bringing a lot of ships, most likely. It's going to be a long voyage. You get one shot at it, maybe two. So you can't count on genetic diversity from home of lots of smaller ships coming with new blood all the time. It's going to have to be one big one. So your population density to get the genetic diversity might be really high. But that's assuming that we have kind of the genetic diversity that we have today, where two people meet, fall in love, have babies.
Yeah.
And do that. But with the advances that we've made in genetic engineering and genetic editing, you know, you could potentially have a sampling of fewer people and engineer differences so you don't get the problem of intermarrying and the gene pool being too narrow when you reach your destination. People have also taken the idea of bringing frozen embryos of huge population diversity along with you. But then you get into all sorts of ethical questions, right? As exemplified today, at least in the U.S., and I know in other places, about when does life begin, you know, the whole issue of abortion and all those things. And then you leave the realm of the purely technical and you get into the moral and ethical, which is something that we'll have to consider. Now, if the voyage isn't that long and you have a really fast ship and where you could conceivably reach your destination in a decade or a few decades, which is really, you know, high speed travel, then suddenly you have the option of, well, you don't worry about the genetic diversity as much because there'll be many ships following you.
Right.
And it would be more like the Polynesians when they settled the Pacific Islands, where they had one little boat and then another boat came along and then another one came. And, you know, you had different tribes and different populations that then intermarried and you had your genetic diversity. So it really is going to depend on your architecture and your technology level. If you have many short trips, fewer people per trip, if you really get one shot at it, you better load it up with as much genetic diversity as you can. Now the people and what their skills are, this is also a challenge. And we have a chapter that talks about what the skill sets need to be and how you set up governance. You know, not it, looking around the earth today, we all agree on the right kind of government, right? So how is it going to be different on board a ship? And people who set out might agree to one form of governance. The people who are born along the way might not like that so much and want to change it. And then you get into
and there are people researching that at the moment. What sort of government? What sort of governance on board an interstellar ship is required for the goal of establishing a colony on another solar system? I mean, really, it's every time I think about it, I think it's kind of crazy that people are intentionally and seriously thinking about these things.
Well, is an area of academic research, and this is where I take off my hat of the person who thinks we're going to go soon, because I think it's still going to be a while. This is an area that has not been researched. And so if you are a young PhD in the social sciences, you just got your Juris Doctorate, you want to be publishing original work, there's a lot of original work to be done. And you get to publish and be the first to think about it, right? And so the example I give is a technical example. And it's not directly related, but it's an analogy. If you go back to the Wright brothers, and they had their first powered flight on that North Carolina beach, and you understood aerodynamics of how they got lift and were able to fly that short distance, you could sit back and say, you know, it ought to be theoretically possible to build an Airbus or a Boeing 777. Of this size, because you could make it go this fast and get this lift and everything. You had no idea about what jet engines are. You have no idea about the materials required for that. But you could theoretically say it's possible to do this. And then that inspires other people to go figure out how to do it. And so I would say the people who are doing this original research on the legal structure, the governance structure, the safety and issues associated with this kind of thing, they're laying the groundwork for what the people will ultimately decide in 100 years when these first voyages launch. Somebody's got to start. And I'm thrilled to be working with the people who are starting to think about these things.
So in terms of the skill set, what is the thinking? I mean, presumably you want an engineering sort of person, and you want someone who knows a lot about the human body. And I mean, is the idea currently the best idea to actually have, you know, quick learners who are, you know, who are focused in a particular area, and then have a giant database of all human knowledge on a thumb drive? Or what's the, how do they figure out that problem?
You basically captured it right there. I think the ideal crew for an interstellar voyage won't be a lot different from the ideal crew for a Mars mission, except in terms of what the succession planning is. And what I mean for that is, if you're going to Mars and you've got eight people, you want to have somebody who's a doctor who also knows how to do engineering, say, right? So, you know, maybe cross training, or you have engineers who cross train on how to be a paramedic in case the doctor gets hurt. So somebody who's a quick learner, has access to information, and can be cross trained easily, I think is the ideal. However, some of the equipment is so specialized that cross training won't work. I can imagine the person who's the expert in the fusion reactor, you know, is not going to have a lot of spare time to learn how to be a plumber.
Yeah.
Right? So you're going to have these specialists. And that's great if you have enough people on board where you have redundancy and all that. But then you have to start thinking about, well, wait a minute, if you're limited by human lifespan, this person's going to grow old and die potentially before you get to the destination. So you're going to have to train those next generations aboard ship on how to do these things. What if they don't want to do that?
I didn't ask for this, Dad.
I didn't ask for this, right? You know, I'll just give the example of my, I have two adult kids. I'm a physicist. Neither of my kids love math, and that's fine. I mean, to each their own.
Is it though?
Oh yeah, that's fine. Okay. I mean, I pursued a different path than my parents, and I instilled in them, you know, if you find a field you like and you have passion for it, you'll never work a day in your life, right? Hmm. And so they're into different areas. My son in software sciences, psychology, and such, and my daughter's in nutrition. And they're really good at what they do, but they're not very mathematical. So that's okay. Hmm. But you're going to have somebody who's mathematical
yes.
on the ship who can then do the engineering and the physics. So it's going to take a good population size, in my opinion, in order to get not only the genetic diversity, but the aptitude diversity that you'll need for maintaining the voyage.
Of course, talking about the sum of all human knowledge, in the last 2 years, our understanding of what computers can and will do in the future has been turned on its head with generative AI. And you devote a section of this book to the role of AI, and that role may not just be a simple repository for information, that actually AI could have a number of different specific roles within a generational ship. Can you talk me through what those are?
Well, this is one area where our author for this had his own ideas, and a lot of people have different ideas. It's difficult to distill it all into one section. But, you know, these smart systems, these AIs, and I'm taking for a moment the idea of a sentient AI off the table, a self-aware, self-directing AI, more of one that's an assistant to us. I think it's a brilliant idea to help make systems more resilient. Because apparently the way AIs work is they can take disparate input and come up with optimum ways to address problems very quickly based on all that disparate data and input. And they learn as they go, these neural programming languages. And on a complex system like a starship, having an AI assistant to keep an eye on things, to run things, to make, if not routine decisions, recommendations for decisions that flow to the human who ultimately makes the call of things that are significant, could reduce a lot of risk and enable us to have far fewer people on board to keep an eye on the systems that are on the spacecraft. Where I get difficulty is where you start deferring the decision making to some kind of logical algorithm in an AI. And the example I would give to that is, in our population today, you know, if we had to make a judgment call of medical treatment given to somebody at a certain age or at a certain stage of a disease versus not, you know, from a purely logical point of view, we would make some decisions that you and I as human beings would find to be abhorrent.
Yeah. But that's workable, and you know, you can build in humanity's moral compass, or at least one human's moral compass into it. It becomes complicated, of course, with different cultures and different ideas of what's right and what's wrong. But in this book, one of the ideas is that perhaps the captain of the ship may be an AI,
I don't like that idea. That was something the author came up with, but I would not be in favor of that. I don't want to, and this is less personally, editor of the volume. I read that. And I see all the excitement among technical people for doing things like that. And I understand that temptation, okay? But from a human point of view, I would never want to cede decisional authority to a machine. Mm. I think a machine that's making potentially life and death decisions of all sorts needs to have a human in the loop at all times.
With this generation of computers, absolutely. I wonder, though, by the time we can get to Interstellar Research Group, will we really be able to determine humans from non-humans?
And that's something, and there's another author that deals with this, the blurring of the lines is coming. With Elon Musk's neural implant, with genetic engineering, with the idea that, people have already gotten implants for being able to have instead of their cell phone with Google Pay or Apple Pay, there's something embedded in their skin.
Yeah.
I wear glasses. My wife wears hearing aids. I'm already a cyborg, to a very primitive one, right? I've got mechanical augmentation to my senses and awareness. My wife does. I have a family member who's a type 1 diabetic, so they have essentially a robotic pancreas attached to them. So the merger of human and machine is coming, but I view, and this is less as ethics coming into this, on an interstellar voyage with people, I just have difficulty seeing people willing to cede that control. Mm. Now, maybe the young people who grow up with it will have a different view when we're ready to take this interstellar voyage and it'll be as commonplace as everything else. But I hope not, because I really don't want to cede that kind of control to anything other than a human being.
Well, luckily, I don't think we're at the junction of having to make a decision on that just yet. And while this research is all very serious and very evidence-based and fascinating, it's still sort of tinged with a sense of science fiction in that.
Well, and that's right. It is. Yeah. And there's a debate in the space community, not just NASA, but European Space Agency. I'm sure it's in the Chinese Space Agency as well, of the right role of humans versus robots. And this discussion of, do we really want to send people to Mars, or we can do everything we want to do with robots, virtual experience, bring back samples, all these kinds of things. And the same question will come up with an interstellar voyage and how that voyage is conducted. What's the role of people versus robots? And I think as a tool, we want to explore all these things, and we have to look at the technology and project where it's going and how it could benefit an interstellar voyage. But that debate will probably still be ongoing in 100 years.
If you are particularly a geeky person who loves to get into the nitty gritty details, because I have to say, this is quite a technical book. It's called Interstellar Travel. It's Propulsion, Life Support, Communications, and the Long Journey. And it's co-edited by Les Johnson here and Kenneth Roy. And if you are of scientific mind or an engineer, you might find some of the ideas in it really, really interesting. But even if you aren't, just flicking through it, it's really, really fascinating to look at what we're considering when we're thinking about what we need to do to get humans from this star system to another. And that's always a good way to spend a bit of time, I find. Les Johnson, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.